Hey everyone, I'm Devin.
And I'm Asia, and we're your hosts, and this is the latest episode of On Their Behalf.
So, I literally spent all day today watching Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, okay.
Which, I don't know if you've seen it, but like, that is an emotional feat, and watching more than one episode a week is really difficult.
Okay.
So I'm in a little bit of a funny brain space.
Okay. No, I've never seen it. It's like on my list. It was like one of those things where I said, you know, oh, I'll watch it, but I want to read the book first. Mm. And then never read the book. So I've been like giving myself that excuse, like, well, you haven't read the book yet. So then you know, but I think I do that to myself anyway, because I really like to binge stuff. Like I'm not like, I don't like to...
This is one, though, that I'm like, it is so heavy that I do not recommend binging it like I did today.
Yeah.
Because this is how I feel now, and I feel bad.
Well, I don't have an excuse to be in the mood that I'm in. I literally almost started two fights at a store today. And I didn't...
I'm going to assume they deserved
it. Absolutely did. They absolutely did, but I'm just in like, you know, let's be real. I'm just in one of those moods where I just like don't like people. Like just like human interaction is just like really annoying right now.
Yes. You know what is also contributing to my like down mood is everything is like opening up, and I saw like this like everything that fully vaccinated people can do and blah, 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 blah. And I am not ready for that. Like I'm anxious and I'm not looking forward to it. Like, I don't have a job right now, but when I go back into an office, like, that is scary to me and I'm nervous about it.
Yeah, agreed. It's a lot. Well, today, you know, this is pre-recorded, so people won't, this will be like old news, but today I saw that like the CDC is saying that like fully vaccinated people don't have to wear masks inside or outside.
Crazy. I'm never doing
And
that.
I was like,
I'm always wearing what? Masks.
Like, I felt very like, oh. And then I was like, oh. Yeah. I had that reaction where I was just like, oh. And then I was like, wait, no, that's very, like, I'm not ready for it. And I'm also still like, I feel like I've gotten used to the way that things have been. And I feel very comfortable in that right now.
Yeah.
So like,
but there's also been, like, a lot of distrust because the CDC was, like, not saying shit in the beginning. Mm. So now I'm, like, they lost trust with a lot of people. And I think that's where, like,
I read that there's, like,
debate comes up. But I'm just, like, I would rather just wear a mask all the time.
I think there was, like, many...
Because what else is out there?
Stores and, like, companies that were saying that they weren't going to lift their requirements. So
interesting.
I don't know how that works legally though. Like,
yeah, I don't know either. But the other thing is like, okay, so this is for fully vaccinated people, but are they going to start like making you prove you're vaccinated and like show your vaccine card? Cause that also feels weird.
Yeah. Like you just have to like keep it in your wallet, like your ID.
Yeah, maybe.
It's like, it's weird. I'm definitely not ready for it.
But then it becomes like, that is a sticky situation about medical privacy and stuff.
Yeah, and, like, the people that...
I mean, I feel like everybody should get vaccinated, but also I recognize that it's...
Yeah.
There's certain people that can't, and it's not...
And it's not like your vaccine card has your, like, photo on it.
Yeah, that's
so,
true.
So, like, what are they going to ask before you go into a grocery
store?
ID
and your photo and your...
It's just... Yeah. It feels outrageous, but it's also, like, I don't know how I feel about it. I'm just going to let everybody else do what they, you know, like when I was in Oklahoma visiting my boyfriend, like there was people, they lifted their mask requirements like months ago. So there's the only thing in Oklahoma was Walmart. So I was going to Walmart to get stuff. And there was people like, there was many people that did have their masks on. There was people that didn't, but we chose to keep our masks on. Like, I wasn't fully vaccinated at that point, but he was. So, but we still had our masks on the whole time.
Yeah. I don't know.
So I'm just like, really, was I ever going to go up to somebody and be like, are you vaccinated? You know, like, but I can see that becoming an issue where like,
Yeah.
You know, going into a store and you decide not to wear your mask, somebody is going to be like, well, are you vaccinated? Can you prove it? And that just feels like a lot of nonsense that I just don't have the energy to deal with.
I know.
So,
I feel so tired already. So, I was watching Handmaid's Tale.
Sorry.
Because at least they don't have COVID in Handmaid's
Tale. Oh, good. That's why I can't watch certain shows right now that are trying to
have COVID.
It's just, it's too soon. It feels like putting salt on the wound.
It's also just like exhaustion. Like, I don't, if I want to watch a documentary, I'll watch a documentary. Like, I'm watching TV to get away. Mm-hmm. I don't need, like, I mean, I don't know. I think if it had been like 3 months long, you know, it would have been a bit of a different story.
Yeah.
But, and I think a lot of the stuff that's airing right now, we didn't know how long it was going to last. We thought it was going to be a couple months.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why. And then by the time that, like, we made that decision and committed to it, it's like,
kidding. I feel like that, right? Like, I'm not that I want to ever be in lockdown again. And I think I might have said this already, but, like, I kind of missed the beginning of it. A little bit.
Yeah, where it was just like,
we were so naive and we were like, it's only going to be a couple weeks or like a month or whatever. Where
I was really scared.
I was terrified in the beginning. Yeah. But then, like, once it was like, okay, we're in lockdown, you know, it felt like
forced.
Yeah, like, oh, we're just going to have a month. We're just going to have a month where we get to be home. And, you know, it's not a big deal. But then when 1 month turned into two and then three and then five, and then it was like, well, this seems like this is going to be our life forever.
The first 3 months of lockdown, I think I was unemployed for.
Yeah.
And then I got a job and then, like, working in, which, like,
you worked from home.
I got a job during
quarantine,
which is, like, you know, unheard of. And when most people lost their jobs, so
I didn't work
very lucky, but also until, like, that sucked.
Yeah, I was unemployed the whole, well, not the whole time, because, like, I started on Grey's Anatomy in November, so, but, like, the actual, like, full-on lockdown that, like, literally nothing was happening, like, you couldn't, like, nothing was open unless, like, there was, like, an essential need for it. Like, that whole time I was unemployed and kind of just, like, twiddling my thumbs. You know, I just missed the beginning part where it felt like it wasn't going to be long, like, that long. And we were just kind of waiting to hear how long it was going to be. Like,
2 weeks.
Yeah. Like, that's the time. And I miss, like,
remember when we called it Corona?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
I was like, when did that stop? Yeah. When did it become COVID?
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I just miss, like, being on FaceTime with my family. We would just, like, drink wine and
coloring
books, like, and
all the Zooms, the social Zooms.
Yeah. Ugh.
But now, now it's the other hand where, like, for me, all of the weddings, including my own that were postponed, are, like, coming up. So now you have double weddings, including the people that got engaged in 2020. Yeah. Plus, then there's, like, the family shit that you have to, like, make up for all the times we didn't see each other. And I basically am booked every weekend for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Which is exhausting.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to go, well, like, we'll be, I'm just going to go on, like, go see my sister and go back and see my boyfriend in Oklahoma. Yeah. Not that there's anything to do out there, but... You know, we're going to just, me and Jackson are going to go out and go to the country.
Country folk. Well, hey, speaking of country folk, my story today, or my case rather today, is not in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if it's close at all, but because I'm very bad at geography, it feels like a similar vibe, but it's set in Mississippi.
Okay, how far is Mississippi from Oklahoma?
I'm gonna look it up. I'm sure it's really far. I know it's not, Mississippi and Louisiana are not that far from each other.
Yeah, I think it's like Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida.
Yeah, I have literally no idea where Oklahoma is.
Oklahoma
is over Texas. And Mississippi is, oh, it's like, okay, there's, it's Oklahoma, Arkansas, Mississippi.
Okay.
So,
I mean, it's still
not close.
Still the South. So,
Yeah, I guess the South. Okay, so anyways, with that beautiful, beautiful segue, I should win an award.
You should totally. You know what? Let's let's make one up and print it out on our computer.
Okay, thank you. I'm honored.
And when we have offices, I'm going to hang it up over your desk.
No, but in all seriousness, today I'm going to talk about the case of the murder of Herbert Lee. So, Herbert Lee was born January 1st, 1912, in Liberty,
Jesus.
Mississippi.
1912?
I know.
Oh, my God.
He would have been 100. Crazy.
Wow.
This is a vintage one, okay. By the way.
Well, obviously, 1912.
If you couldn't tell. Yeah.
Well, every time I hear the date 1912, that was when the year Titanic sank.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. He was born the year the Titanic sank. And he was born January 1st. Okay. So, like... The year.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that's not vintage. That's like, I mean.
Well, yeah, when does it go from vintage to antique?
I don't know. I would say 100 years, so it's definitely, so I would say it's antique, definitely
this
antique.
This is an antique case.
An antique case. Yeah.
His father was named Albert, and he was a farmer, and his mother was named Elvira Turner. And I was like, whoa, Elvira's a real name?
I don't know if I've ever met an Elvira.
I thought it was just the gothy lady. All I know is literally like the goth queen of the darkness, whatever, Elvira, entertainer lady. Mm. So
was there an Elvira in The Little Mermaid?
Who? No?
Ursula, sorry.
Oh.
Continue.
Anyways, that's right. So he's born in 1912, right? And in Mississippi. So that's only 47 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Wow.
So I don't know how old his parents were when they had him, probably 20s. But it is safe to assume that his grandparents were born enslaved. Mm-hmm. Or were enslaved at some point in their life. So... the fact that he's living in a town called Liberty, Mississippi, is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
I don't know when Liberty was founded or whatever, but it seems like Liberia kind of vibe, right? You know? Yeah. So Herbert and his wife had 9 children.
Jeez.
And his wife's name was Prince Melson.
His wife's name was Prince?
Yes.
Okay.
So, okay.
So, not traditional for that time.
Very, like, interesting names.
Yeah, okay.
Over here. I don't know if she was American or, like,
okay.
French or something. I'm not sure. I couldn't really find much information about her except for about, like, involving him.
Yeah.
So, they had 9 kids, and by the 1950s... they had built the farm that he had inherited from his dad, which was a dairy and a cotton farm, into a very successful business. So he was, like, very well off in farming community all through, like, 30s, 40s, 50s, which is a big, you know, accomplishment.
Yeah.
Herbert didn't receive a formal education growing up, and he never really... learned to read at like a proficient level, but his wife did teach him how to sign his name, which I thought was sweet. And I couldn't really find too much more about Herbert's life up until 1952. I think he was pretty much the sort of reports around town of people who knew him was that he was pretty quiet and he kind of kept to himself, but like an honorable man, a businessman. Just somebody reliable that you could count on and that wasn't really, like, involved in a lot of town drama, gossip kind of stuff. He just kind of like kept to himself and worked and was a nice guy. So in 1952, Herbert was 40 years old. Mm-hmm. And this was the year that Herbert's friend and another farmer in the area named E.W. Steptoe, another amazing name.
Steptoe. Like T-O-E or T-O-W?
Yeah. S-T-E-P-T-O-E. Steptoe.
All right.
I love mm-hmm. it. So E.W. Steptoe organized the Amity County chapter of the NAACP. And that's the county in Mississippi that they lived in.
Okay.
And so the main goal of this chapter was to register Black Americans to vote.
Okay.
Also, that county, Amity County, was the most, the phrase was Klan-ridden county, so KKK mm-hmm. activity happened a lot there, in the whole state of Mississippi. So even just, like, whispering anything about NAACP was super dangerous. And this was important, getting Black males to vote, because Mississippi's Constitution of 1890, which so after Emancipation Proclamation, mm-hmm. That Constitution had politically disenfranchised Black Americans by creating voter suppression tactics like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses that excluded them from voting. At that time, in 1952, there was only one Black person registered to vote in all of Amity County, and he never even voted because it was so difficult.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So then I was like, okay, wait, I need to, like, learn a little bit more about, like, this voting
mm-hmm.
timeline, just to give me a little bit more context.
Yeah.
So in 1870, a few years after the Emancipation Proclamation, which that is a tongue twister for me. Congress passed the 15th Amendment, which stated that voting rights could not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So that was, like, the thing that gave Black men the right mm-hmm. to vote, because that was still before
women could vote.
But I'm like, okay, great. That seems pretty clear. Mm-hmm. Like, no ifs, ands, or buts around it. But because this is in, like, the Reconstructionist era mm-hmm. where, you know, the Southern states are trying to regain footholds mm-hmm. and, like, regain economic control after losing their free labor force, essentially.
Yeah.
They didn't like it, so they found all these loopholes and, like, other tactics that they could to discourage Black men from voting. Mm-hmm. So, because they couldn't discriminate about who could vote based on their race, they found other qualifiers that lined up with the Black experience at the time and made those the standards for who couldn't vote. And Herbert was a good example of who they were targeting mm-hmm. because he wasn't literate. He didn't read well. So he would have failed the literacy tests at the poll.
Okay.
And they would have said, like, that's the reason you can't, because there's no way you could be educated on what you're voting on.
Okay.
So you can't vote. Or the other one was the poll taxes, which is like, okay, so maybe you can pass the literacy mm-hmm. test, but, like, can you afford the poll tax? Herbert could have afforded the poll tax, but wouldn't have passed the literacy test.
Wow.
So there's just all of these hoops to jump through, not to mention the intimidation, mm-hmm. the,
yeah, I'm sure, know, like, you know, even having the balls to go. Like, even if you knew that you would pass a literacy test and you could pay the taxes or whatever, like, going to, like, any of these polling places, I'm sure there was many people outside, you know,
mm-hmm.
threatening them, you know, and it was just, like, not worth it.
Yeah. And it's the same thing that we're seeing now with, like, that Georgia bill that was passed where people couldn't, like, it's, like, shortening the hours of the polling mm-hmm. places. Nobody's allowed to volunteer and hand out water or food or anything.
Yeah.
And it's all designed to make it harder for these marginalized voices to vote. And there's already such an attitude of, like, it's such a hassle. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I have other things going on. What is this? I'm going to vote on this thing, but is it really going to affect me?
Yeah.
Like, nobody gives a shit about my well-being anyway, so why should I participate in a system that wasn't made for me? Yeah. All the same things we're hearing today.
Yeah, you know? And, like, you know, I did, because it wasn't in Georgia, it was, like, their polling times were so short, as well as, like, a lot of companies weren't allowing their employees the time mm-hmm. off. So then they had yeah. to pass some sort of bill or law or whatever that was just like, you have to let your employees off for yeah. the time that they need to vote. But then it was just like limited to 2 hours or something like that. And that wasn't long yeah, enough because all the lines were super long. Mm-hmm. It's just like fucked up.
And it's just like literally trying to get people to not mm-hmm. vote because you know that the people are going to vote against whoever the powers that mm-hmm. be's interest, yeah. you know. So in this case, without these black votes taken into account, more and more laws were passed that benefited white people mm-hmm. that we know as Jim Crow laws. Yeah. So fast forward to 1952, okay. where since 1890, that has been the case. Mm-hmm. So it just feels very deeply ingrained, really difficult. It's been like 60 some odd years of this at that point. And it just is just bleh. Yeah. like, it feels impossible. So this creation of the NAACP chapter is a big deal.
Yeah.
And Herbert starts going to the NAACP meetings. Mm-hmm. They're held in a neighboring farmhouse, and he becomes a charter member of the chapter. And for 9 years, mm-hmm. Herbert and other members of the chapter canvass the area in Mississippi, working to spread information about voting registration and taking cues from the larger civil rights movement that was happening at that point as well. So people began to know Herbert and know what he was about, and suddenly this, like, quiet, non-threatening, nice guy is, like, stepping out, yeah. let's say. So this is where somebody named Bob Moses comes into the picture. So Robert Paris Moses, who was born January 31st, 1935, mm-hmm. and he's still alive. He's an educator and a civil rights activist who is known for his work leading the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee on Voting Education and Registration in Mississippi, according to his website.
Okay.
And he co-founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. So Bob Moses, in 1961, had received a BA from Hamilton College, a master's in philosophy from Harvard. He had been a teacher in the Bronx, as well as a private tutor to a singer named Frankie Lyman. Which I was like, what a yeah. name. But because he was tutoring Frankie, Bob got to go on tour with him and toured all around these different black neighborhoods in the country with this doo-wop group.
Yeah.
And Bob credits that experience for his recognition as the emergence of a distinct black urban culture across the nation, mm-hmm. which is so cool. And Bob Moses and Dr. King were sort of like contemporaries of each other, but their styles were very different. But they both really recognized each other's styles mm-hmm. and were really, you know, supportive of each other. Bob had more of a vision of a grassroots and community-based leadership.
Okay.
But I thought that that detail was really cool because we, today, look at Dr. King as, like, the end-all, be-all mm-hmm. of the way to be and the way to have, you know, you usually compare Dr. King and the Black Panthers or Malcolm X in terms of their approach, which, like, kind of very different approaches, but, like, Bob Moses's approach feels more similar to like AOC or Nithya Raman mm-hmm. for those of you who are in LA, which just feels like very community centered first and like ground up, whereas Dr. King was sort of looking at
the big picture.
And I thought that was great because it's like there's room for both approaches.
Yeah.
Both approaches are valid. Both approaches are going to be better in certain situations. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that, like, having different approaches and a common goal is something that I feel like is lost today, where we sort of get very much like, this is the only way to be. This is the one way to yeah. see it. If you see it any other way, you're wrong mm-hmm. and you're bad. Mm-hmm. But, like, in most things, there's a lot of nuance
yeah.
that's very difficult to just mm-hmm. have one approach for, because everything changes in certain situations. So I was just really inspired by that, like them being different and working together and still respecting each other and still both making a big difference. All that being said, Bob in 1961 traveled to Mississippi as the director of the Student of Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's Mississippi Project. And Herbert, being one of the only guys in town with a car, volunteered to be Bob's driver, as well as transporting other SNCC activists. And when Bob arrived, tensions were high. This chapter of the NAACP had been working in Klan territory, for lack of a better phrase, for almost a decade. The civil rights movement was going strong, in like, you know how that goes. So this was no different. The white community was threatening, harassing, and intimidating black voters and black people who showed up at events to learn. And a lot of that vitriol was directed towards Herbert because he became known as one of like the main members of this thing. And Bob at one point was even like detained and beaten up by a group of white people for just trying to do his work there. So because of that, and then because of seeing how Herbert is treated whenever they would go out in public and shit's thrown at him, yelled at him, and he's like very stoic, unmoved
by it,
unruffled, like did a lot of that like desensitized training to not engage in that and just keep his eye on the ball. But it was concerning. So and concerning that, like, how specifically it was, like, targeted at only a few people, Herbert being one of them. Yeah. So on September 24th, 1961, our friend Steptoe, who was the original founder of the chapter, testified with Bob Moses to John Doar, D-O-A-R, of the Justice Department, that somebody who was an actual Mississippi state representative... like a government official named E.H. Hurst, was publicly threatening to kill Steptoe, a man named George Reese, and Herbert. And even with documentation and proof of these threats, Doar of the Justice Department denied giving any protection to any of the men that were threatened.
Oh, big surprise.
Yeah. So on September 25th, 1961, literally the day after that, Herbert was... working for the farm. He was transporting cotton to a cotton gin near Liberty in the morning because he had a truck and it was his family. That's what he was working. I don't know why I have to explain what working is because I've been unemployed for like so long.
That's probably why. I mean, what's work? I don't even know what that is.
I don't know. So that morning when Herbert got to the cotton gin, that Mississippi State Representative, E.H. Hurst, confronted Herbert. And he had a gun, but Herbert said that he wouldn't talk to him until he put the gun down. But instead, Hurst charged Herbert's car and shot him point blank in the head.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Not to mention, all the employees of the cotton gin were surrounded and saw exactly what happened. Yeah. Just like broad daylight in front of a group of people, shot him in the head. Wow. And he fell out of the car.
But you know what? It takes that much balls because he, you know, he's emboldened by all of these different, like the lifestyle of like how you treat people like this. Of course they're gonna, you know, he's gonna go in there guns a-blazing and not give a shit. What, like he probably had no thought in his mind to be like, maybe I should do this at night when nobody can see. Like he knew he would get away with it.
Yeah, and the other thing is, as a state representative, I'm sure he spent most of his time hearing from angry white people about how all these black people were ruining everything. Mm-hmm. So he knows the numbers that will stand behind him with this.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. After he shot him, Herbert's body fell out of the car and laid on the ground for 2 hours uncovered, and because nobody wanted to touch him or deal with him. Police didn't want to touch it. Nobody wanted to get involved. No individuals wanted to touch it and get involved. Nobody covered him up either, which I was just like, why would you not do that? So finally, the crowd there got a funeral home in Macomb, Mississippi, to take his body in, according to Bob Moses. So what happened, I'm a little, like, confused exactly what happened, but they took the body in to the funeral home where a coroner met them to look at the body. The coroner also had them bring in E.H. Hurst and witnesses for what is called a coroner's jury.
Okay.
So, like, I'm weird.
Okay, so, like,
no arrest was made. It was literally, like, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the Celia, a Slave trial.
Yeah.
Where they just, like, somebody just, like, asked her questions.
Yeah.
And not really, like, any due process or anything. But it really feels like, it feels like a small town trying to, like, figure out the situation before mm-hmm. doing anything about it.
Yeah.
That was kind of the vibe that I got. But basically, at this coroner's jury, which is such a weird
I'm so confused by
I know
that. But what year is this again?
1961.
61? Okay. All right.
I know. So a coroner's jury is, according to Wikipedia, a body convened to assist a coroner in an inquest, that is, in determining the identity of a deceased person and the cause of death.
But,
so it's not a trial. Okay. It's not anything like that. It's just like,
mm-hmm.
it's weird.
Yeah. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's just like.
And I feel like that's why we haven't really heard about it, because it's like.
Yeah.
It feels like a grounds for a cover-up, which brings
to, me yeah, to, okay. Which I feel like that's where you were headed with it.
Yeah.
Regardless of what, you know, happened in that coroner, I feel like the coroner's jury would not have been applied if a black man killed a white man.
Oh, no. So. That also would have been mob justice, so this is just the mob trying to get in front of it now. Yeah. I say mob justice with, like, the most sarcasm. So at this coroner's jury, Hurst claimed self-defense.
What?
He said that he had confronted Herbert in an argument over debts, and that Herbert had attacked him with a tire iron, and that his gun had fired in the ensuing skirmish.
Okay.
Which,
just want to point out, though, using also, the word skirmish, but...
I know. Also, though, exactly the excuse that those stupid fucks in who murdered Ahmaud Arbery used.
Yeah, self-defense.
No, the scuffle and then the gun.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
if guns can just go off by themselves, there's a problem. A bigger problem.
Yeah, and just like the stupid fucking fucks that killed Ahmaud Arbery. Yeah. Like, Hearst wasn't caught on tape, but Hearst had a fucking...
group of people that obviously saw him.
Group of people watching.
But it's just is this Hearst guy allowed in the jury? It's just, it's the equivalent of a serial killer getting up to represent himself. It's just like...
It's, well, maybe not, because that, a serial killer representing himself never goes well.
No.
But...
Well, you know,
see how it goes for Hearst.
It's just a way for them to be able to control the narrative.
It's narcissistic,
yeah.
And it's exactly that, where they think like they're gonna trick everybody because they're smarter than everybody.
Yeah,
yeah. So on the drive from Liberty to Macomb, mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to look up how far that is. Hold, please. Okay. So it's a 30-minute drive, like, with today's car. So okay. 40-minute drive. Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know. Like, bad stuff. From Liberty to Macomb. And on that drive, again, this is where it gets a little, like, dicey, because I don't know who was driving, who rounded everybody up.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
All this stuff. But Hearst had cronies with him.
Okay.
Or came after, whatever, and took some witnesses to Macomb. And on that drive, those people on Hearst's behalf were intimidating and threatening to all the witnesses, so much so that they sat in the coroner's jury and corroborated Hearst's story.
Of course.
And they're all black workers.
They were all black workers?
One. Not the people doing the intimidating, but the witnesses who saw it.
But they had a whole 40 minutes drive for whatever. Yeah.
Right. For whatever to happen. Mm-hmm. And one witness named Lewis Allen was like the sort of cornerstone witness who worked in the cotton gin, who knew Herbert and backed Hearst's story. So, of course, the coroner's jury, which I'm like, is it just the coroner who decides it? Is it actually a jury? Yeah. I don't know. They declared that, it was a justifiable homicide. Mm-hmm. So no arrest was made. Nothing. No trial that I could find. Nothing.
Wow.
So.
Okay.
Isn't that just, like, bananas?
It's absolutely insane, but
it's wild.
You know, I'm not surprised. Which I'm so, like, numb to it that I'm like, you know what? Of course.
It really felt unplanned to me.
Yeah.
You know? Or maybe not. Maybe, no, it felt unplanned. But Hearst wanted to make a show of it to regain power. I think he probably snapped.
Yeah.
But the sort of scrambling and doing it in front of so many people that you had to threaten to corroborate your story and then not being able to find anywhere to, like, take the body.
Yeah.
That's the part that feels unplanned to me, but it's like showing up with a fucking gun. Mm-hmm. But then because of how sloppy it was and still being justifiable homicide, but when you're being told by literally everyone that, like, no, he attacked him with a tire iron and it was an accident, like, okay, I'm not okay, but, you know, I don't know.
You know, for me, it's like, okay, he attacked you with a tire iron. Okay, it wouldn't have been a fair fight regardless, and you shot him in the head.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to be, I don't know, like, I'm just, like, people that, like, I just don't buy people, you know, being that good of a marksman to, like, shoot somebody in the head in a scuffle.
And if you're saying, if you're saying the gun went off in the skirmish, like, look at a MMA fight. If somebody's holding a gun.
Yeah, it's not going to, like,
it's got to be, like, right on the temple. Yeah. Like,
there's got to be some intent behind it in order for you to be that good. Like, if he got shot in the leg and, or the foot.
Right.
Or
the neck,
yeah, that, like, would have been a little bit more like, okay, I get that that could happen in a scuffle, but, like, come on.
Yeah.
To be that precise.
And like, to be precise and him to die immediately, because it's one thing, and it's like the gun goes off, shot in the stomach, bleeds out.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. This is very graphic. I'm sorry, everyone. So, okay. I'm going to rewind a little bit, talk a little bit more about Hearst. I'm going to call him Hearst. I usually like saying people's first names, but his first name is E.H.
Okay.
So I'm going
to
say Hearst.
Only like to say the first names of the victims because they're the only ones that really matter in, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I get it. E.H.? Yeah. What would be E.H.? Edward?
Well, like, Elmer.
Harris.
Elmer, that makes me think of glue. Elmer's? Is it glue?
Yeah, it is glue. Okay, so the kicker for me. Ready? Mm-hmm. Herbert and Hurst had grown up neighbors and were childhood friends.
What?
Yep. And through adulthood, they had remained friendly.
Okay.
And Hurst is white, obviously.
Yeah.
I feel like that's obvious, but also I don't know if I said this, so I'm going to say it. But Hurst had helped Herbert apply for a loan to get the farm to be what it is.
Okay.
So, like, that, I was like, damn, that's, like, what we were saying is, like, real allyship, right? Yeah. Which is, like, going to the fucking bank and, like, putting your name there and your, like, to help your friend of color. Yeah. Like, wow. So.
How did we get to this?
How did we get here? And it literally started when Herbert joined the NAACP because.
Oh, okay.
Before that, he was quiet and mild-mannered.
Yeah. Kept to himself.
The sort of model black man. You know, like, it, the respectability politics of it. Yeah. Like, he was the kind of black man that was palatable for white
people. Yeah, and he stayed in his place. He never caused any issues. It was like he was in this very invisible type slavery that still followed everybody of color around. Like, you knew, you know, it's just like the Emmett Till. Like, everything was, you know, for the most part, the desegregation, like, everything, you know, everybody was able to do whatever they felt free to do. But if they stepped out of line, like, his mother being like, don't, you know what, how you're supposed to speak to the white man. You know how this, you're not supposed to be in situations that can offend a white man or a white woman. Like, that was its own type of slavery and control.
Yeah.
So as soon as he stepped out of that.
That was only 6 years. Yeah. That was only 6 years before this, I think, Emmett.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, you're really good at dates, because I did not remember that.
Well, I could be wrong. I think that was 1955.
Yeah.
Let me look it up.
I should be embarrassed. It was my story, and I can't even remember the date.
1955. Okay.
Let's cut that out, and then I'll just pretend like I already knew. No, leave it in. It's totally fine.
I don't think anybody's expected to remember, like.
Yeah, after.
I was doing research, so I'm sure it came up on this.
Yeah, and know? I think we're on, like, episode 32 or 3 of our podcasting life, so there's no way I could remember the episodes and dates of anything, really. But.
No, but I think doing this many episodes with talking about the themes that we talk about, it's starting to be very easy for me to see correlations and patterns and the events surrounding that lead to this kind of thing.
Yeah. Especially the time too. Like, if this like, you can even just based on, you know, the events that happen and kind of the inner workings of how things ended the way that they ended, and they all pretty much end the same, but just certain things can be like, okay, well, that can be, you know, grouped in with 10 other episodes we did because it was around the same time, you know?
Right.
So.
And everybody, yeah. And this is like what happens when you educate yourself too, right? Like, you start seeing the bigger picture that, like, sometimes when you are just hearing about a single event, it can feel like out of nowhere in a vacuum and all this kind of stuff. But there's so many other aspects that you have to take into consideration. But also there's such a personal thing where it's like, if something is happening to you or you're involved in something, you feel like it's very individualized, but it never is, which can make you feel like less special or less important, or make you feel like something, part of something bigger, depending on the situation. But I think there is such a strong feeling of, like, I'm special and I'm unique and I'm not a number, I'm not a statistic, I'm not like, I'm smarter, I'm one person, I'm not like society, I'm smarter and I can recognize, like, society's influence and all this stuff. And it's like, maybe to a degree, but not really.
No.
Like, society plays so much more of a factor in all of our individual choices, like, from brushing our teeth. I literally learned about how brushing our teeth became a thing, and it's not because of dentists, it's because of advertisers convincing people in the 1930s that, like, the film that you get on your teeth, which isn't inherently bad, is something that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
Because before that, it wasn't, like, nobody cared.
Yeah.
Or you just, like, swished water.
What? Really?
Right? Yeah, I'm reading... Okay, I'll tell you the book I was reading that.
Okay.
It's from... Let me pull it up. All my sources today. It's from The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg.
Okay.
Crazy, right?
So wait, like, people obviously...
People didn't brush their teeth before.
Yeah.
And now it's, like, the... And it is good for your dental hygiene, yeah, for sure. Course. Like,
yeah.
The claims are true. Mm-hmm. But that film, that that specific thing is not inherently bad or good. Mm-hmm. Like, tartar and plaque is bad, and, like, the germs are bad. But the film is the thing that we can feel. And so that was the things that advertisers use to trigger people to be like, oh, I need to brush my teeth.
Yeah. And but that's also, oh, my gosh, that's so interesting. Because the thing that actually you should be doing, like flossing, because of the plaque, like the plaque tartar and the bacteria that is in between your teeth, is the actual killer.
Yeah.
But people just brush their teeth because they don't want to feel that film. Yeah. They don't want to feel like their teeth are not clean. But really, the thing that cleans your teeth and, like, stops, because plaque is, like, one of the major things for, like, heart disease too.
So isn't that crazy?
It's wild. But it just, like, oh my gosh, the realization that, like, people think by just brushing their teeth they're being healthy, or they're, like, their dental hygiene is, like, you know, perfect. It's, like, totally the opposite. Because, like, you can brush your teeth every single day and still have terrible gingivitis.
Yeah. It's also why they put the minty fresh flavor on the floss or in the toothpaste, because that becomes the reward that you seek after you do it.
Okay.
So that's what creates a habit. This is now talking about the habit loop.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm learning about with this book. But it's like craving, which is the, or trigger for the craving, which is the film on your teeth. Action, brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
Less so flossing. Reward is the tingly feeling.
Wow.
And it's that simple, and that's what advertisers used. And that's why this one brand of toothpaste called Pepsodent,
okay,
which was the first to put the tingly minty thing
in their toothpaste,
was the one that blew up and made it a thing.
Wow. Ugh.
So the next time that you think you make any
decisions on your own, you don't.
On your own, you don't.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's the Matrix. Yeah. Anyways.
Oh, God.
Highly recommend that book. Yeah. I'm very much enjoying it. So, 10 days after Herbert's murder, 115 black high school students marched through Macomb, Mississippi in protest. And after that ruling of justifiable homicide, the work of the voter registration movement stopped. Bob Moses decided to pull out of Mississippi and shut down the NAACP chapter there because he realized that he couldn't guarantee the safety of the activists. Wow. And they fully left the county, not the state, in 1962.
Wow. Ugh. That's terrible.
I know. So, a few years later, in 1964, Lewis Allen, the witness, one of the main witnesses who corroborated her story, who was forced to do that, testified to federal investigators that he had been forced into his original testimony. And somehow that got out. And in the following months, Lewis was harassed and jailed repeatedly by the Amity County Sheriff Daniel Jones. He was intimidated. He was threatened, everything constantly for months. And it got so bad that he had made plans to move out of the state. And the day before he was supposed to leave, Lewis was shot and killed in his front yard.
Wow. Oh my God. I kind of saw that and coming, though.
Yeah. Ugh. His death was never solved officially. But his case has since been reopened, I think in the late 90s, and investigated by Tulane University professor Plater Robinson.
All right, Plater.
Just, the names are just
weird. They're
amazing.
Yeah.
Very Southern. Mm-hmm. And the case was reopened by the FBI, and I think Cold Case did an episode on it. Okay. But all of their independent work suggests that Lewis was killed by Daniel Jones, the jailer who was harassing him, and it was in retaliation about coming forward about Herbert's murder.
Ugh.
Yeah. So this case is significant because Herbert was the first local person and not leader of any movement to be killed by white violence because of his involvement in the civil rights movement. And his death was senseless and absolutely avoidable, and it galvanized the movement as a whole. So, you know, in the short run, the SNCC leaving the county and Bob Moses pulling out in an effort to protect its activists is a loss. It is a loss because they had to give in to the terrorism that was happening there.
Yeah.
Ultimately, like, the impact of the entire civil rights movement was a win because people saw, white and black people saw what they were up against and realizing, like, how much harder they had to fight. So it's also, though, is a problem because the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which is, like, what we all attribute the big win of the civil rights movement was only signed into effect after the assassination of Dr. King. If he hadn't been killed, the uproar and everything after his death would not have...
Yeah.
That legislation wouldn't have passed. Or wouldn't have, you know...
Even been in... Like, that probably wouldn't even been heard of at this point.
Yeah.
Jesus, we would still be fighting. Fuck.
Yeah. So it's the idea of, like, a martyr being the only thing that can actually enact change. You know?
But we're still seeing it every day. Look at George Floyd.
Yeah, exactly. But that's exactly right, because people don't listen until it's too late. And lawmakers and government and even the everyday Joe Schmo. Yeah.
Well, look at what, like, Nancy Pelosi said after... After Derek Chauvin's trial. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
Nobody.
And, like, why?
Yeah, and this is the thing with, like, the martyr is, like, after their death, other people decide that's what they are. Yeah. But, like, isn't there something about, like, I feel like in the definition of the word martyr, and I used that word just now, I think it's, like, you have to choose. And there's nobody is choosing
way. Like, who would, though? Like, we want change to happen without people having to lose their lives over it. And, like, I'm sorry. And, like, whatever she said that day, like, it also just, like, opens your eyes to the amount of people. Like, she doesn't fucking write her own speeches. Like, we know that, like, everybody in politics has speech writers. So who the fuck wrote that shit out and got it approved by somebody for her to get up there and say that without having any, like, respect or knowledge for his family or, like, really what his death was? And it wasn't about that. Like, he shouldn't have had to die in order for this shit to happen.
No.
It's crazy. It just boils my blood. Ugh.
Yeah, and it's also crazy because this is obviously not a new fight.
Yeah,
this is something that the people in 1961 are asking for the same stuff we're asking for now. You know, like, the voter suppression thing is still happening.
Yeah,
and so what kind of democracy, when people are demanding this and standing up for this kind of stuff, demanding to hold people accountable for crimes that they commit. Why does a democracy not listen to its people? It's because it's not a democracy, it's a business. Yeah,
exactly. It's about money.
It all comes back to capitalism.
It all comes back to capitalism.
Capitalism.
I think we've said that every episode for the past four episodes.
I mean, I feel like it's my, this is my...
Your thing?
Core belief now. Yeah. And it's a new belief to me, but it's not a new belief to a lot of people. And I don't know what the replacement is, but I don't like this anyways. So, at least one of Herbert's nine children, named Herbert Lee Jr., went on after his dad's death to continue to participate in the civil rights movement in his memory. And Herbert is memorialized in Bertha Gober's song, "We'll Never Turn Back." I couldn't find a good recording of the song, but I would have played it if I could.
So everybody go Google it and listen to it.
I'll do my best to find a good recording to link on our Instagram if you're interested in hearing the song. Yeah, and even though, you know, this season we've covered a lot of these sort of historical vintage antique cases, whatever you want to say, and this was one of them, it still feels so insanely relevant to things happening today. And hopefully talking about Herbert's life and Herbert's death and the aftermath, hopefully people start recognizing the patterns, because like this book that I'm reading, The Power of the Habit, is the first step is recognizing it. And then change comes when we replace these detrimental habits with positive habits. So, you know, let's make positive habits, like contacting our representatives, letting them know what we want, whether or not we think they're going to listen.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the people in this country do have power. Mm-hmm. So we can take our activism further than just Instagram. Mm-hmm. My heart goes out to Herbert's wife, Prince. They're nine kids, and I'm sure now grandkids. This week's episode was written and edited by me, Devin Balsamo-Gillis, with music by Holly Amber Church. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. On their behalf, thank you for listening.